I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, a college kid's journey into a hate group. Our commentator watched it happen. That's next. But first, in the last couple of days, we've been talking a lot about so-called hate crimes, acts committed with the intention of hurting or frightening someone because of his or her race or gender or religious background, sexual identity, and so forth. In Gina, Louisiana last summer, a set of nooses hung from a tree at the local high school set off months of racial confrontations among high school students. At the University of Maryland last week, a noose was displayed near a building housing a number of black-oriented student organizations. And we were curious about the fact that both incidents apparently involve young people. Now, attitude surveys show that Americans are more tolerant than ever, young people most of all. So we wondered, why do some young people still commit racist acts, some to the point of being attracted to hate groups? To talk about this, we're going to ask two former racists who have changed their ways. T.J. Lydon is a former skinhead who now works to educate others about racial tolerance. Angela King is also a former skinhead who spent several years in prison before changing her beliefs. And we'll also be speaking with Randy Blazak. He is a sociologist at Portland State University who has studied white supremacy groups in depth. And I should warn our listeners that this is a sensitive topic, and there might be some language in the course of our conversation that many people will find offensive. And with that being said, thank you all for joining us.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Thank you.
TJ, if we could start with you, how did you get involved with a hate group?
I got involved in the skinhead movement shortly after my parents divorced, and they were trying to find themselves, so to speak, and I had a lot of free time. So I started hanging out in the streets, and I got involved in the skinhead movement before it became racist.
Really? Mm-hmm. What was it initially?
Initially, it was a bunch of working-class kids from a bunch of different backgrounds, especially in Southern California. It was a lot of Hispanic and white kids. And then shortly thereafter, it started branching into more and more white supremacy. And then we divided into two subcultures.
How did that happen? Was there some, like, a powerful adult or somebody who started reading literature, passing it out? What happened?
Well, a lot of us started getting in trouble. We started going to jail, and we started picking up a lot of the jail philosophy, and we started seeing the racial separation in jail. And a couple of the groups went one way. They started becoming and talking about being anti-racist skinheads, or what they call sharps, and we became white power.
What do you think attracted you to the white power wing?
I was in a very, very white area, and when I was getting in trouble, I was hooking up with white guys in jail, so that whole philosophy just followed me back out onto the street.
Angela King, what about you?
Actually, my story is very similar to his. My parents divorced. There was a nasty custody battle, and I had many issues that I didn't really realize then. I had identity issues. I didn't feel like I fit in or belonged anywhere. I struggled with weight issues and my sexual identity, and it was basically just in my high school. I met some skinheads, and they just seemed to be the perfect place for me to fit in.
What was it about their philosophy or whatever that do you think was attractive to you? Just because they were interested in you?
Well, that was the initial attraction. I felt wanted. They gave me the sense of family that I wasn't getting at home, and they actually wanted me around and wanted me to be a part of what they were all about.
Did anybody around you notice this was going on and try to talk you out of it, or was that part of the issue, is that nobody was paying close enough attention to you to keep you away from these folks?
That's a tough one to answer. In my household, I grew up with prejudiced parents. I heard the N-word at home. I never really grew up in any neighborhoods that were culturally diverse. So when I initially started getting into it, it was more so, don't get in trouble for it, not that it's wrong to think like that.
Interesting. TJ, you? Did you grow up hearing stuff at home?
My dad was, I guess you can call him a stereotypical, I guess in a way, a bigot. He would go to golf with anybody. It didn't matter what color you were. Just didn't cut him off on the freeway. Because every dirty word was going to come out of his mouth. It's very similar. You know, I tell people, you know, a lot of these kids come from this kind of background. Her story's not too unsimilar to mine. And that, you know, we had identity issues, we had anger, we had frustration. And this group was the group that was able to mold that into what they needed it to be.
Randy Blazak, is what you're hearing familiar?
Well, it's actually familiar to me, too, because I grew up with a similar story in a Klan town in Georgia, also with parents who were divorcing. And the Klan was sort of, you know, had our back in a sense. And one of the things about these groups is they offer a kind of way of making sense of the world, especially when we're young. The world doesn't make a lot of sense. We want an easy answer for things, and the real world isn't like that. But these groups have, you know, nice conspiracy theories. You can always blame it on some Jew conspiracy running the government. They give you an identifiable enemy and an action plan. You know, you're going to fight for the survival of your race, and that is very appealing to a young mind. Fortunately, I kind of got out of that world, but a lot of the people that I grew up with didn't. And in the past 20 years, I've kind of spent time talking to folks who have similar stories to Angela and TJ about how they got into it. And you do hear the same story over and over again.
And are young people the main targets? Teenagers.
Sure, because they're the ones, first of all, they do want some type of family setting. So like a cult or a gang, it offers you this sort of immediate family surrogate, but also helps you understand why the world is so screwed up. And gives you this thing to do about it, which as we get older, we start to realize that sort of everything is a shade of gray.
TJ, were you involved in the skinhead movement before you joined the Marines?
Yes.
And somehow being in the Marines didn't change your attitudes at all? Because I thought that the military was supposed to be one of the great integrating organizations in our society where that kind of stuff wasn't tolerated.
Well, the military is a good organization, but they don't teach tolerance. They don't teach racial understanding. They don't teach racial harmony. They basically say, we're going to order you to get along, and that's just the way it goes. And that's not the way it is. And the problem is, the one thing that the military did teach me was to become a better recruiter. And I took the military tactic of tear down and rebuild, and I was able to really change a lot of people's outlook. And a lot of those philosophies were adopted into a lot of the way the white supremacy movement recruits today. One of the main facets was music. You give a kid a piece of paper, he may read it one time. You give a kid a CD, he'll listen to it 1,000 times.
So you have racist performers or artists with a racist message, and you use that as a tool?
Oh, big time. And we have concerts. Concerts were a huge way of showing camaraderie and belonging and things of that nature.
Randy Blaser?
It's a broad continuum where you have fairly organized groups like the Hammerskin Nation, but you also have kind of neighborhood groups that have the same sort of rhetoric. And it is, you know, we talk about it as a racist movement, but it is heavily male sexist. You know, basically, and Angela may have some comments on this, you know, the job of the woman is to have more white babies.
Exactly.
So the white race doesn't disappear.
Is that true, Angela?
Theoretically, the white racist woman, that is her duty in life. So, you know, procreate. That's what you're expected to do.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to former skinheads T.J. Lydon and Angela King and Professor Randy Blazak about racism and how those attitudes take hold among young people. But talk to me a little bit about this whole noose business down in Gina. Now, in the University of Maryland, we don't know who put that noose in the tree. You know, nobody knows how that happened. But down in Gina, and I don't mean to imply that those three, the kids who are known to have hung those nooses or belong to a hate group or anything of that sort, but it does raise the question of why would they do that?
Yeah. Well, first you have to make the point that most hate crimes are not committed by members of hate groups. It's only a small percentage that are. But hate crimes are a form of terrorism, pure and simple. The first anti-terrorism law is the Anti-Klan Act of 1871, and those are symbols that are meant to terrorize large populations. Whether it's a swastika written on your notebook at school or a noose hanging from a tree, those are messages that are sent to intimidate people.
Do you think they really know what those messages mean?
Yes.
TJ, you think so? You think so?
Come on. With a noose in a tree? Yeah. You know, you're not putting that in there because, you know, you're going to, you know, hang a pinata and you're going to, you know, invite everybody over to, you know, do something. They did it as an expression of intolerance and hatred.
Professor Blazak, you were telling us that one of the reasons these groups have to constantly, or maybe it was TJ, one of you was telling us that one of the reasons these groups are constantly recruiting is that people get out. So I'd like to ask you all, why did you get out? Randy, if you want to start.
Well, part of it is that people just start to figure it out, and they figure out that we live in a diverse world. You can't change some of these major issues, and so you kind of have to figure out how to exist in a very diverse world. And also people start to develop personal relationships, especially with females. I mean, my research has been a lot of folks leaving because males develop a relationship with the female that says, well, what about me? You know, what about people that want to target me just because I'm female? So there is this constant outflow of folks.
Angela, what about you? What made you get out?
In 1995, during the time of the Oklahoma City bombing, I was 20 years old, and when I saw everything that happened there, it really stopped to make me consider what I was doing, if I did have children, would I want to raise them like me? I made kind of half-hearted attempts to get out and was not successful. So instead of continuing to try to distance myself, I redoubled my efforts and became the best racist I could be. And it wasn't until I actually went to prison and had the opportunity to meet people from all over the world, albeit they were criminals, I had never felt that before. And honestly, when I learned to like and love who I was and take responsibility for my own actions, that was the key turning point in my life.
That's interesting to me because I think a lot of people think of prison as the place where racial identity gets hardened, in part for self-protection. It didn't work that way for you.
Not so much in federal institutions. I was in a women's federal correctional institute, and it wasn't at all like that.
TJ, tell me about your experience. What made you finally move away from the white supremacist movement?
So many little things. I didn't have an epiphany moment. I guess the closest thing to an epiphany moment was when me and my son were sitting down watching cartoons on TV. We were watching a show called a Nickelodeon called Gullah Gullah Island. Mm-hmm. And my oldest son, who was three at the time, comes out, turns the TV off, and turns around and scolds me. And he said exactly this. He said, "Daddy, we don't watch niggers in the house." Mm. Now, my first impression of my three-year-old son was, because you got to remember, I was a racist at this time, was I was proud of him. But then as I'm sitting there watching him and his little brother play, I'm starting to think that who are they going to be in 10 years, 15 years? And that outlook was extremely bleak.
So, Professor Blazek, is TJ's experience and Angela's experience also typical that people just grow out of it?
Yeah, I mean, there
and
are a lot of...
The countervailing information somehow starts to penetrate when it didn't earlier?
Right, it starts to make sense. And, you know, and part of it is this idea of how do I want my children to grow up? Do I want to grow up in a world that made sense when I was an 18-year-old male, but now seems, you know, like a living hell? Do I really want to do this? Folks, if you are going to be a full-time racist neo-Nazi, for example, there are things that you can't do. There are foods that you can't eat. Because eating them acknowledges multiculturalism. There's music that you can't listen to. There's people that you can't talk to. Cartoons that you can't watch. And all of a sudden, you know, you realize that you've built this wall around you. And so I had an experience with two 16-year-old skinheads I was talking to at a lunch at a school. Their teacher called me in. And one of them was eating a bagel and the other one was eating a peanut butter sandwich. And I said, "You guys are the worst Nazis I've ever seen. Peanut butter, that's Jewish food. And peanut butter, or bagel is Jewish food. And peanut butter was invented by George Washington Carver, who's black. You are celebrating diversity right now." And they were really upset. They're like, "What? I love bagels and peanut butter." And so one of them called me and said, "You know, I'm not giving up peanut butter for anybody. How do I get out of this?" Which is, you know, a little bit of the larger picture of people kind of figuring out that we are the products of diversity and we're stronger for it. And when you start building these walls, you're just cutting yourself off and you're only hurting yourself. And then when you start hurting your children, then you really kind of start to reflect, what am I doing with my life?
Randy Blazek is professor of sociology at Portland State University. He joined us from Oregon Public Broadcasting. Angela King is a former skinhead who is now a graduate student at the University of Central Florida. She joined us by phone from her home in Florida. And T.J. Lydon joined us from our studios at NPR West. He's a former skinhead turned educator on racial tolerance. His new book, Straight Talk, will be published this fall. Thank you all so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for doing this.
Thank you.
Thank you.